Welcome to the Manoa 100 Centenary Podcast, part of the Decade of Centenaries program. In this, the fifth in our series, examining the events of 100 years ago, arrests of suspect women had begun in the closing months of 1922 and continued for the remainder of 1923. Constance de Markovitz was arrested in November of 1923, but she was released the following month along with the remaining female prisoners. Arrests had begun in earnest in the early months of 1923, and Mountjoy Jail was soon overcrowded with women political prisoners. Richard Mulcahy, in his role as Commander-in-Chief of the National Army, told the Adjutant General of the Cabinet decision that Kilmainham Jail would be used for women suspects. And in February, women began to be imprisoned there. One of the events that stands out is that in April of 1923, a commemoration took place at Easter to mark, as the prisoners called it, the seventh year of the Republic. In the archives, I read programmes written in different handwriting, each a version of the programme giving details of the concert. The poem read, P.H. Pierce's The Wayfarer, Joseph Plunkett's Treason, Thomas Macdonagh's Speech from the Dock, and songs, The Battle Hymn, Easter Week, and The Foggy Dew. Looking at a piece of paper listing songs and poetry, the only way to really feel and get a sense of what it was like for the women at the time is really when those songs are sung. Now, a century on, Irish folk artist Alva Reddy records from an 0100 her own unique interpretation of the beautiful song that is The Foggy Dew.
And my heart with grief. was sore, for I parted then with Phalion, and whom I never shall see no more. But to and fro in my dreams I go, and I kneel and pray for you. For slavery fled, oh glorious dead, when you fell in the foggy Jew.
Among the prisoners were relatives of the executed 1916 leaders. Meanwhile, outside the jails, in the first months of the Irish Free State, government departments were being shaped, and the functions of Ireland, now a partitioned country, were coming into being. It is rare to get first-hand witness accounts of events of this time, certainly for those living 100 years on. But in 1994, the opportunity arose for me to interview one of those suspect women, Tessie O'Connell. She had replied to a letter that I'd written to a newspaper seeking information on women held in Kilmainham Jail during the Civil War. By then, she was 92. She had been arrested when she was 21. Teresa, known as Tessie to family and friends, was the second youngest of the 11 of the O'Connell family in Caherdaniel, County Kerry. She had three brothers and seven sisters. She began by telling me of her mother's family, the O'Sullivans of Kerrig, County Kerry. Her mother was a teacher, as her father had been before her. He had been dismissed for his radical nationalism. He and his brothers were Fenians. Jeremiah O'Sullivan, her uncle, was an exile in the Bronx in New York. When he read of the treaty, he wrote, "I am glad, in one way, they're making a settlement of some kind, although it is far from the settlement of our times and expectations." His sister, Tessie's mother, Marianne, had been active in the campaign of independence. She was described by a contemporary as putting her home, her shop, her goods, her time and money were always at the disposal of those active. A pure patriot with a heart of gold, who kept the spirit alive in that part of the country.
I was at home when the treaty was signed, and I remember how horrified my mother was.
In prison, Tessie was part of a group known as Suffolk Street, and she was arrested at the Republican offices in November of 1922. Those employed there worked to oppose the formation of the Irish Free State.
I came up to Dublin, I think it was in March 1922. I got a job in the Republican headquarters in Suffolk Street. And I was there for some months, and the Civil War started then in June 1922, and the men, of course, all left the office. What we were doing mostly was propaganda work. When I went to Dublin, I remember I was at a meeting when Collins signed the pact with them. There was great rejoicing that they had signed the pact, but in a few days, I remember the morning the forecourse was attacked. We were awakened by the sound of the guns, and I remember my sister coming into my room and saying, "Did you hear all that bombardment?" I said, "Yes." So she said, "Attacking the forecourse." She went away then. I didn't know where. I didn't hear for her for a long, long time.
Kathleen, Tessie told me, went away, meaning that she went underground. She worked with Eamon de Valera. He described her as his helper and friend. They were now in opposition to those who were working to establish the Irish Free State. Kathleen had travelled to America with her uncle, Father Michael O'Sullivan, at the age of 16 and trained in a secretarial college there. By 24, she was secretary to the American delegation of the Gaelic League in New York City, working at 624 Madison Avenue. She came to know all those who came to the United States and met P.H. Pierce. She handled confidential documents and monies for the Irish Republican Brotherhood. She had a big influence on her younger sister, Tessie. When she came home in 1915, she brought with her material from the US, and she had, as she later described, hinted at things to come. Before she returned to live in Ireland, she had been part of the consular staff in America with Dermot Fawcett. By 1923, Kathleen O'Connell was by Eamon de Valera's side and would remain his confidant for the remainder of her life. Once years later, the Sunday Dispatch published an article, and their advertisements for this article showed her picture with the headline, "The Woman Who Knew All the Secrets."
The Civil War started then in June 1922. And the men, of course, all left the office. There were the President de Valera and the Austin Stack and Shanti O'Kelly and Charlie Murphy and the Paddy Little and who else now? Oh, well, Fred Cogley. And Liam O'Brien, he was a young fellow like myself. And when the Civil War started, they left the office. Then we kept on the work. And then that was all going on until November in 1922, one day soldiers, the army, burst in and they were top brass. One of them was Emmett Dalton. There was a huge big table in the middle of the floor and we had it full of envelopes putting in propaganda stuff to send out to the bishops of Ireland.
Eamon Dalton described as top brass. In 1922, would Tessie have known, as we do now, that it was he who convinced the provisional government to use artillery against the anti-treaty forces in the forecourts? Was that rumoured then? What we do know is that on the evening of the 9th of November 1922, at 5 o'clock, he was in Suffolk Street.
The army came in and, of course, went all over the place. And upstairs, in one of the offices upstairs, if anything happened, we were supposed to go to ring up on the telephone, but we didn't get time to do it. And anyway, they searched all over the house. And I hadn't had any lunch that day because I had gone out with dispatches and I was really hungry and so were the others. And we asked if we could go down to Robert's Cafe. It was just a few doors down from us in Suffolk Street. But they wouldn't allow us out. And we asked if they'd ordered a tea in for us, but no. So eventually we were taken, they waited until the crowds left the city, and we were taken, I remember, along out to Portobello Barracks first, and we were put into a room there with a fire, and where they were having their evening meal. And after an hour or more, we were huddled into the cars, and we didn't know where we were going. The others who were Dubliners knew, of course, but I was a stranger and I didn't know where we were going.
Mountjoy Prison on the North Circular Road was Dublin's county jail. It was a convict prison and had both men and women prisoners. In November 1922, if they had travelled up the main street of the capital, it would have been through a street with ruined buildings. On one side, the General Post Office, which had been burnt in 1916. On the other side of the street, the buildings that had been destroyed in the previous months in what was known as the Battle of Dublin. The remains of the Hammond Hotel, where Cathal Brua had been shot the previous July. And further down the quays was the Four Courts Law Complex, where many of their leadership, now in prison, had been arrested when the buildings had been bombarded by the National Army. Those men detained were now also in Mountjoy Prison.
They did it in the night time when there'd be few on the streets, you see. So we got to Mountjoy.
In this time, with the censorship of information, walls of silence, women and men were arrested, taken from lodgings, places of work, from the streets. No announcements or reporting to families. For Tessie's family back in Kerry, what did they know of what had happened?
Of course, they all got a shock. But you see, that time the post was disrupted and everything. They could hear, I suppose, for some time. I suppose they were worried, but it was the order of the day then. We had to give our names and addresses. Lily O'Brien told me to give her address because she knew she'd be raided anyway. So I gave her address, 44 Oakley Road.
Letters from 44 Oakley Road survive. They are now in the archives of University College Dublin. Lily's letters to her sister, Áine Cant, who lived at 44 with her son Ronan and their mother Elizabeth O'Brien. Áine, writing to her sister Lily during her time in prison, gave a vivid picture of the nature of those raids. She wrote, "We have now fixed up the kitchen, but the rest of the house is not habitable. Eamon's photograph is disfigured beyond recognition, and the picture of the Sacred Heart was deliberately cut in five places. In 1921, when the Black and Tans raided, they did not destroy it. You cannot imagine the house or the minuteness of the destruction. Blouses torn to shreds, my brown coat. Some of your blouses torn, and the legs only of the piano remain. The marble washstand, the wardrobe in your room beggars description. We've received the greatest possible kindness from the neighbours, unionists and all. One of the raiders had a white handkerchief over his face and his cap pulled down over his eyes, so he must have been so well known to me. I would not like to think that he had sunk so low as to help to destroy the house of a man whom he knew so well in life." Tessie recalled former comrades that were now opposed to them in this current conflict.
And remember, Phil Cosgrave was the governor of Mountjoy at the time, and Pauline O'Keefe was the deputy governor.
Phil Cosgrave was governor. He was the brother of W.T. Cosgrave, now president of the executive of the Irish Free State. Some accounts say he was deeply affected by the events of the Irish Civil War. In fact, he died just over a year later, on the 22nd of October, 1923. I locate his death certificate on Irish genealogy. Yep, dead at 39 from kidney disease. You can speculate on the reasons for his premature death. We know that he left the running of the jail to his deputy, who features in many of the accounts of this time. Patrick O'Keefe, better known as Pauline. He was from Cork, near the Kerry border, an early member of Sinn Féin who'd risen up through the organisation during those years of war. He was imprisoned himself after the 1916 Rising, and later on too. The Dictionary of Irish Biography entry records that Pauline predicted that the verbal war would soon be a killing war. He had been one of those trying to retain solidarity until the Collins de Valera Pact, which aimed at a coalition of national interest to prevent a Republican split. I asked Tessie to tell me about him.
He was small. He was good at earlier times, you know. He was in Hawker Street, number 6 Hawker Street. He used to be there. But, of course, they changed over completely then when this treaty was signed.
For Tessie arriving that night in 1922, her recall remained vivid across the decades.
We were taken up to this ward, long ward, and it was so bleak. There were no lights, no electric lights at all. There were little, what we called, glory holes in the wall, cut out in the wall, and a gas light. The beds were ready for us, but not made. We had those yellow calico sheets and dark brown blankets.
The former hospital ward had 9 beds. The women started to call their cells after different patriots or places. Tessie's dorm became known as Suffolk Street. Mountjoy is still a prison today, and the Dublin City Education and Training Board in the Education Centre have been marking the decade of centenaries with their own work, including an exhibition, Women and Mountjoy. The exhibition is displayed on the railings outside the prison. History teacher Paula Egan asked members of the history class to look at the physical reminders, items that were there 100 years ago and now.
Okay, what we're looking at here now is an original cell door. Just looking at the makeup of it, it seems to be timber sandwiched between 2 sheets of tin steel. There's a small spy hole for the officer to look in at the prisoner. And also on this one, there's a flap. It's probably for passing in and out food or stationery or something like that. What do you think?
Yeah, they actually had them doors back in 2008. They start changing them around that time because they start upgrading the prison. The hatch where the food was given in, that was done away with, but they had the actual, them old original doors. So I think what they done was they welded back up the field hatch.
Did they, yeah?
And they had the original spy hole.
What we're looking at here now is a series of keys. Some are original keys from the 1850s, from when the prison was first built. Like, I hear the jangle of keys, I know what time it is because an officer's coming along to do a check. I hear the jangle of keys, you get that little flutter, oh, is the door going to open? You don't know what it is. Are they coming in to search? Or are they just walking past? You don't know. Everything, my life revolves around keys and I haven't got them.
Yeah, it's just the control that keys in prison obviously affects you. Where, like, if you're at home, you have your own keys.
Yeah,
you control,
of course, yeah.
When you go, where you go, what you do. In here, it's the complete opposite.
They open the door, tell you to eat your breakfast. They open the door, tell you to eat your lunch. They open the door, tell you to go to the yard.
Some of the women did not demurely accept the rules and regulations of the prison. Those who were in favour of a state of war in prison lived on the top landing. And others occupied the first floor. Protesters were led by Sheila Humphreys and Moira Comerford. And as a result, they were both placed in solitary confinement for a period of time. As more arrived, there were several prisoners to each cell. Designed for one person, protests began.
Another thing we found out, that when the ladies used to be protesting, they used to throw all their stuff from their cells, including the beds, out onto the landing.
Just looking at the old bed there, just the way it's made, like, to be honest, I'd be more happier with that bed than I would have the bed that I have today. The bed that you have today is the fixed bed, but it's also, it's like solid steel rib.
Yeah, 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 the way that it's like the lattice work, exactly, of the steel. But then, as you say, look, if you don't get a good night's sleep,
oh, it affects you the next day.
Yeah.
Tessie spoke to me of her first night in prison in 1922.
So eventually we went to bed, made our beds and went to bed. And we couldn't sleep, you know, wondering what was going to happen. And anyway, Madame Cogley started to sing. And I remember she sang some song, I forget the words of it now. We had the next day that the soldiers who were out on patrolled around the prison were surprised to hear the singing coming from our place. The day before, Mrs. Humphreys and her daughter Sheila were arrested, and Anna O'Reilly, Mrs. Humphreys' sister, they were in cells up over our room.
These women were once best remembered as the sisters and niece of the O'Reilly. Michael O'Reilly, one of the founders of the Irish Volunteers, who had been killed in the fighting in 1916. That changed about the same time that I was speaking to Tessie. Ruan and Moncon McGann set out to tell their grandmother's story. It was a docudrama, the first of its kind, with women at the centre.
So we thought maybe we should tell a story about our own personal family's history, about Sheila Humphreys, about the stories she would tell us. Sheila, I think, was in bed and sleeping, and Dick Humphreys and Dick, her brother, was asleep, and suddenly they're woken up by an attack on the house, a raid on that house. The Free State soldiers had surrounded the house, came in shooting. There was a whole shootout with Ernie O'Malley shooting, everybody shooting, and my great-grand aunt had a bullet sent through her mouth or through parts of her head.
Ernest Bernard O'Malley was then 26, a leading figure of the Irish Republican Army who opposed the treaty. He had been captured and escaped. He was Assistant Chief of Staff and part of the Anti-Treaty Army Council. Anna O'Reilly, was known as Anya or Anno, was taken to hospital. Her face was disfigured from the gunshot wound.
Anyway, it was such a vivid story, and I wrote an account and I sent it to Ruan, to my brother, and he said, let's make a film of it. He had been working on locations, as locations manager, on big films like Michael Collins, directed by Neil Jordan. So he had experience of film, and he knew how to tell this very dramatic story in a cinematic way.
The house in Aylesbury Road is still there, now an embassy.
The French embassy were only too happy to give us use of the entire building to recreate the shootout that happened there in November 1922 with Ernie O'Malley, Sheila Humphreys and the rest of the family. And so we made that programme, and it had such an impact. People really saw it as a visceral, visible, eloquent sense of just one single story of the fight for freedom in Ireland. But it was such a dramatic story, and women were such a key part of it, with Sheila most likely being the only person who shot and killed a man on that raid. You know, Ernie O'Malley was drilled with bullets, 12 or 20 bullets riddled through him, but he didn't die. Nobody died except one poor young 18-year-old Free State soldier. He was shot with a single bullet from on high. And when we recreated, you see, every journalist who turned up for that street fight and every officer and every soldier gave their own first-hand account. By mapping out all these accounts, we realised that the bullet that killed young Commandant McCarthy from Monaghan could have been shot only by my grandmother. It was my grandmother who killed him.
Tessie remembered Nell Humphreys setting up an altar in the prison.
Mrs. Humphreys put up an altar in landing, a wide landing in the top of the stairs between our two sets of cells. And she had a picture of Our Lady of Perpetual Succor put up there, and flowers. And at night time, we used to kneel there and say prayers, you know.
After she was released from prison, Nell Humphreys commissioned 3 stained glass windows to be installed in the prison chapel.
What we're looking at here now is the beautiful stained glass windows up in the church in the progression unit in Mountjoy. Originally, the church was part of the female Mountjoy when Mountjoy was initially built. The windows themselves are triptych because there's 3 of them.
Mm.
And there's Christian iconography, there's the Mother of Perpetual Succor, and there's also pre-Christian iconography. It's like cherubs or like maybe little elf-like or nymphs. Oh, what is that what you just call them? But it's really, really beautiful work.
I was over in that church a couple of times before different events, and obviously going to Mass on Sunday or whatever. But I noticed the glass being there, but I never realised that the glass was by Nell Humphreys.
I think the glass was done by Harry Clark, but it was commissioned by Nell Humphreys.
That's what it was.
In the weeks following her arrest, Tessie received a letter from her mother. On the 21st of November, she responded to Tessie's letter. She had heard that her family home had been described as the Four Courts. Her mother explained that on the 22nd of August, 1922, the house had been attacked and windows had been smashed. It was the night, as her mother wrote, poor Michael Collins died. She said it was the work of an ignorant, cowardly rabble. Despite the family's Republican stance, her mother said that no one in their neighbourhood had a keener regard for Michael Collins than their family had, and she described him as a brave and gallant soldier. The news of her home place's destruction had come from new prisoners who had arrived.
We got another bunch of girls up from Kerry, from Tralee, and they were all, some of their brothers were in the IRA, you know, and they used to work. They were really good fun because they used to chat and pull Paddy O'Keefe's leg. You know, he was supposed to be the deputy governor, but they treated him as if he was a local boy.
There was a sinister side too. The deputy governor shot into a cell through a keyhole when a number of women prisoners were inside. Miraculously, no one was hurt. Margaret Buckley also wrote in her memoir of a bullet coming through a window in the prison as soldiers were shooting outside.
We had, you know, odd times of trouble. But they were funny periods too. When Pat Pete Knight came, there was a Mrs. Buckley there, and she asked Pauline O'Keefe, he was the deputy governor, but we always called him Pauline. She asked him what was he going to do about pancakes. One of his favourite replies was, oh, it's a free country, you can do what you like. So anyway, she said, oh, the girls want pancakes for tonight. So then he said, what do you want for pancakes? And she mentioned flour and eggs and all that sort of thing. And that evening, when it was dark, he came along with an orderly. And out of his uniform overcoat pocket, he took out a bag of flour and sugar out of another, and eggs. So we had our pancakes.
Entertainments were held to pass the time. As Tessie talked to me of those imprisoned with her during those months, confined together, of their shared experiences, I think now of them living in fear. Legislation known as the Public Safety Bill was passed in Dáil Éireann on the 27th of September 1922. This gave the National Army powers. Military courts imposed the sentence of death. Executions commenced, first of low-ranking officers, and then on the 24th of November, Erskine Childers was shot. And on the 8th of December, Liam Mellows, Rory O'Connor, Joe McKelvey and Dick Barrett were also executed. I asked Tessie, does she remember that?
Yes, I was in Roger. We held them, actually, that morning on a Sunday or a holy day. We'd have to go to Mass at 7 o'clock in the morning in another part of the prison. We had to go to our own grounds. Our grounds were small, but we had to go through the grounds into another section of the prison for Mass. And I remember we used to always get a lecture at Mass, but that morning we didn't. Mrs. Humphreys asked us on our way there if we had heard digging during the night. And none of the others heard digging, but she said she did. And we were wondering what was the digging for. And then when we were coming back from Mass, the part of the prison where we had the Mass was where they had the remand prisoners. And one of those called out, said, there will be executions today. So when we came back then, the breakfast wouldn't be served until about 10:30. You know, we'd be all that time hungry. But we had got parcels in from outside and had tea. And we were making our tea in the wardens' room for our breakfast. And we were wondering, and we were sitting down the roof in our dormitory. We were sitting at the table and wondering who was going to be executed. We were saying that it must be somebody who was recently arrested. While we were finishing breakfast, we had the volley swinging out, and we had to, the place we were in, the windows were high up, you know, and each had a stool and a little table. And I remember getting up on the stool at the table and then clinging on to the bars. And I saw the men who had done the execution coming back, and they were chatting and laughing and swinging their revolvers.
For Tessie, on that winter day in 1922, details of what she had witnessed stayed with her.
And then there was a sentry box outside. And in the sentry box, there was a soldier kneeling down. He probably knew the Rory O'Connor and Lee Mellis. They probably knew the men. But they were more executioned after that, of course. One of the girls who was in with me was an Annie Moore from Kildare, and her brother and her boyfriend are both executed. They were dreadful times, really.
Margaret Buckley also wrote of Annie Moore of Kildare, an inconsolable-looking girl. Her description was of this poor girl in a bad state of health. She described her as a tangible part of the shadow that hovered over the jail since the terrible morning, a bare month before, when those girls fell to their knees as shots rang out and deprived Era of her fine sons, Rory, Liam, Dick and Joe. Tessie and the other prisoners were transferred to Kilmainham Jail. It was a disused prison in 1922. Kilmainham Jail is now open to the public, a national monument, restored by voluntary workers. Many of the voluntary workers were in fact prisoners who had been held there after the 1916 Rising or during the War of Independence, and also during this period of the Civil War. When I was visiting Tessie in the 1990s, I was working there as a guide, and later as a curator. Now, in this centenary year, I visit the jail. I want to look at the archives. Women prisoners themselves or their descendants had donated items, what we call material culture or ephemera. Their autograph books, clothing made in prison, a chair leg that Sheila Humphreys had used while she was in prison as a rounder's bat. I want to look at the playbills, written in a host of different hands. Beautiful cursive handwriting, commemorating the 7th anniversary of the Rising.
We've arrived this morning really early. It's silent, it's quiet, because there aren't any people in the jail, and jails by their nature are busy, noisy, loud places, you know? And the idea of Kilmainham being without people is sort of strange. So when it's lively and there's school tours and people coming through, it's sort of closer to probably what people experience. So we're in the east wing of Kilmainham Jail, and this is the newer wing. In a way, it feels brighter because of the way that it's designed. And it's also now repainted the way it would have been and re-whitewashed, and the light and the brightness of the white paint immediately feels uplifting. So completely different atmosphere, completely different feel.
Moncon had been visiting Kilmainham Jail for decades.
Sheila at those times would have brought me to her cell, but it didn't really impinge on me until about 18 years ago. I went to visit the jail, the cell, and her name, Sheila Humphreys, is still over it. And it's so wild, the fact that, you know, she was last there in 1922, 23. But of course, the reason the cell is still there, untouched since she left it, was because the jail closed down just a year or two after. It was left just as she had left it, with her graffiti on the wall. Of course, the graffiti is all in Irish language. Everything she did was in Irish. Every word she tried to speak to me was in Irish. But the one thing that's in English is underneath the pipe that runs through the cell is this note saying, "Tunnel begun in laundry behind wall," or something behind. And, you know, she wrote it in English so that if someone else came along later, they would be able to continue digging the tunnel. And it's said that the guardians, the guards, were well aware of the tunnel the whole time, and that Poideen O'Keefe, the famous governor that they all talked about so much in their diaries, that he just let them at it as a distraction in a sort of patronising way. Whether that's true or not, we'll never know.
Tessie did not keep a diary. But when I spoke to her, she told me her own story of this time in Kilmainham Jail.
I was up on the top floor, and Dorothy McArdle, she had a cell next to me, and Grace Plunkett was up on that floor too at that time. Afterwards I saw something, some cell down on the ground floor that she had painted something. But she was up on the top floor.
I went to the place that Tessie spoke of, the cell, which had the painting, which was on the ground floor.
On the wall of this particular cell, it's the famous Kilmainham Madonna that was painted by Grace Gifford when she was here. A standing woman holding a baby, but it's a really lovely Madonna and child. Her head against the baby's head, and it's mother and child both with their eyes, you know, closed. And it's a lovely moment of sort of solitude and reflection as well. And then you've got Lily's beside them, which is appropriate, of course, because she was here imprisoned in the Civil War.
Married in 1916 in the prison chapel just hours before her husband's execution. And then in 1923... 7 years later, Grace found herself in prison. This time, for her opposition to the Articles of Agreement for a treaty between Great Britain and Ireland. She was there commemorating Easter, marking the anniversary of her husband's death. She spoke to fellow prisoners of Commandant General Joseph Mary Plunkett, concluding with the words, "Glorious and unconquerable to the end, and was passionately content at having with his own hands set the hallmark of freedom on his own country." Nora, the daughter of James Connolly, another of the executed leaders, addressed the assembled group, saying that when her father signed the proclamation, he had signed his death warrant. She told her fellow inmates that she saw it as an honour and a privilege to visit the place of execution. And she repeated the words of her father spoken at his court-martial. While we hold that faith, the cause of Ireland is safe. 300 prisoners raised their voices in song, singing the hymn, Faith of Our Fathers. Leading at the front of the procession to the place of execution, it was reported, the women of Easter Week, Mrs. Humphreys first, then Nora Connolly, then Lily O'Brennan, Grace Plunkett, followed by the other prisoners. An account of the proceedings was smuggled out of the prison and printed in the newspaper. Era, the Irish Nation. It reported the Requiem Mass. Lily O'Brennan spoke in Irish and English, describing being imprisoned in Kilmainham Jail in 1916. She also spoke of the death of her brother-in-law, Eamon Cant. Nora Connolly read the proclamation, and Grace unfurled the tricolour and laid a wreath in the yard where her husband and the other leaders were shot. Markings on the walls of the prison show us that the women were here. You can still find these inscriptions, paintings, mostly in the older part of the prison. When I make my way there, the coldness of this place, its stone walls, it just makes you shiver. The atmosphere of an old building where so much hardship and sorrow happened. The hunger strikes, the illness, the suffering, the feelings linger. Whether you believe in ghosts or spirits or energies, something lingers here. Dorothy McArdle wrote ghost stories while in prison. 9 of these were published as Earthbound in 1924. She dedicated one to Tessie O'Connell.
We went into Kilmainham then for 7 months, and whatever the girls went on hunger strike, I wouldn't be allowed to go to a restaurant. I was supposed to be too young. I could be about 21. And then they came in the middle of the night again to move us to North Dublin Union. And of course, we put up a bit of a protest because we didn't know where we were going. And some other soldiers were very rough there.
The women used the tactics of the suffragettes. There were actually suffragettes among the women prisoners, and they directed their fellow inmates. They tried to stop the removal from the jail, fearing that hunger strikers in isolation and the prospect of their deaths alone. We know now that no women died. No woman was shot. But there was a fear then, and it was ever present. Dorothy McArdle wrote up these events of that long night as Kilmainham tortures, that transfer between prisons.
But eventually we got to the North Dublin Union, and it was much better there. You know, we had big wide space for recreation, and it was much better there. So I was there until towards the end of October. When I came out of prison, I went home to Kerry. And I was at home for a couple of years. And there was no hope of getting work anymore because the Free State had taken over. And there was no chance of getting work. So I eventually went to America and I spent 5 years in Chicago. And I came home then for the Eucharistic Congress. And then I got work in Dublin after that for the Hospitals Commission. Oh, I've seen a lot of changes down the years. They were stirring times. They were hard for those who were closely connected with the movement.
I asked Moncon McGann to reflect on what happened when his grandmother left prison.
And Sheila wrote that we were flattened. We felt the Irish public had forgotten us. The tinted trapping of our fight were hanging like rags about us. And there was a sense, despite the sacrifice, despite knowing that her mother and her aunt had been in prison and had endured such hardship, and that she herself had endured hardship, but she seemed to thrive on it, and the death of her beloved uncle, the O'Rahilly, and just the amount of hurt and upset, she thought, what have we got for it? We haven't got a united Ireland. That was all she'd ever fought for. So no wonder she was demoralised. No wonder she was regretful. And like, that sadness and regret never left her. Her whole life, it was an open wound, the fact that the six counties were still part of the United Kingdom. She would have done anything that she could in her power to have turned back time so that they had fought for an entirely free Ireland and that Ireland was one island rather than having partition, rather than having this division in it. She couldn't concentrate on the Republic being free, knowing that she had abandoned her fellow countrymen up north. And it remained a wound for her forever. And it's why still in the 1970s and the 1980s, she was so actively involved with the hunger strikers, with Sinn Féin, with the struggle in Northern Ireland.
So returning now, what remains in the jail after all these years?
So we're going across the grating and you can see right down to the two corridors below, and it's sort of a link corridor. So if we go back over into this other corridor, you see this completely new corridor. So it's like a little maze. In this section, you still have the original tiles, so you can just about make them out. They're red and yellow, and the whole corridor is tiled. And a big wall facing onto the cells that are here, and then it leads down to an open door, which has a spiral staircase, which would lead you down into the exercise yards. And when the women came back to visit in the 1930s and onwards, they would sign their names on the wall of the prison. And what you have stuck to the door, which I always loved, is these sort of like cloakroom tickets, if people remember those, or raffle tickets, where you have a number. So this is 167. And then above it in chalk is 12. I suppose the most interesting piece for me is the remains of the graffiti. We know who the graffiti artists are. There's nothing anonymous here because of what was recorded. I suppose the most moving is the piece that was done by Bridie O'Milan. So we go into Bridie's cell. So we're entering into a pitch black cell. On the outside, the label is 166. So it's in complete darkness now to preserve what's on the walls. The walls were, multiple layers of paint over the years. The prison, it was already a disused prison, so the fabric of the wall itself was already crumbling when it was painted on. And the only way that we can see what's written on the walls is with the use of a flashlight. You see the year of 1923, so it's 100 years old. And it says, "A few men faithful and a deathless dream," which is a quote from Terence McSweeney's Warriors of Cool. And the signature or the of the woman who was here, Bridie O'Milan, she's written A Prisoner Here, 1922 to 1923. And over the door, you have a rifle and the symbol of Cumann na mBan, or the initials of Cumann na mBan. So up on the wall, you can see the Irish flag, the tricolour, and it has IR on it, and that's Irish Republic. We have to remember that the women who were imprisoned here during the Civil War 100 years ago were still fighting for an Irish Republic. They were known as Republicans or anti-treatyites, and they did not want to accept the Irish Free State. And when they left here, you know, they had a difficult life in the Irish Free State because of their stance, many of them still continuing with opposition to the state, so it meant that they wouldn't sign an oath of allegiance. And then they found it difficult to get jobs because they had been in prison and they had been so vocal in their opposition to the workings of government. Some of the graffiti is original to the women being imprisoned, and some of it relates to them coming back as tourists, or you know, putting their own sort of mark on the jail at the time. The prison has been in the upkeep of the OPW for the last number of years, so what we see here is, you know, restoration. And so it's wonderful that Kilmainham is now open to the public and has its own museum, because it's important for people to have a repository to tell this story. It was restored because of its connection with 1916, because of course this is in the execution yard where the 1916 leaders were executed, and the people that restored it were many of the people who had been imprisoned here. They were called the voluntary workers, and they would come back. Many of the women used to describe themselves as Kilmainham widows because their husbands used to spend so much time here at the weekends restoring the jail, and they're the people who saved it from ultimate destruction.
For us growing up in my family, the focus of the Ireland's fight for freedom was always on women. All the stories we were hearing were about Cumann na mBan, were about my grandmother's time in prison, when we'd have Maura Comerford and other people coming to the house. They'd all be retelling their stories of their fight for freedom. So for us, it was never just a story about the glorious men. It was always this brigade of women who were supporting the IRA in every single way they could as this auxiliary army.
Maura Comerford was imprisoned and had recorded her memories. They have just been published and edited by Hilary Dully. But Mon Con had heard it firsthand. Was it more than just a revolutionary history, or was it a love of Ireland?
It's interesting. Now my life is so much about focusing on Irish culture and Irish traditions, and I realise that is entirely due to Sheila Humphreys' legacy. You know, she made sure that I never heard a word of English until I was 4 or 5. We were immersed in a world in Irish. And then quarter of the year of every year, we would be down in Kirkcaldy in the West Kerry Gaeltacht, speaking Irish, speaking with old Blasket Islanders. And that was because the O'Rahilly had brought the whole family to the Blasket Islands from about 1912 on. They went out, they slept on the floor of Pegsairs, of the island of the Crianach, of the island man and the king of the island. And they learnt the Irish there, and they learnt the mythology and the songs and the culture there. So when I came along in 1970, the Blaskets were no longer occupied. The government had forcibly removed them, but the people were still living there, and they were still close friends of my granny. And we'd just spend time talking to the old islanders, hearing their songs and their stories, their words and their insights. And it utterly impacted my life, utterly changed it. And then I suppose, you know, because we then spent a decade making travel documentaries around the world with minority people, I could see the connection between the rich connectedness to land and to lore that was in the Irish community in the Gaeltacht areas, and how that was united with these other First Nations or Indigenous cultures around the world. So it's funny, it has had a profound impact on me and my grandmother in so many different ways.
Impacting your life and changing it, the past and the present. My return to the jail 100 years on, as I listen to guides in the present, continuing to tell visitors what happened here, looking at the objects and manuscripts and the items donated by so many over the 3 decades since Tessie gave me her autograph book to put in the prison archive and gave me the picture of her mother standing in the doorway of her Kerry home with the chief, as so many people, including the O'Connells, called Eamon de Valera. Tessie is now dead a quarter of a century, but today her voice lives on, captured on an old cassette tape. And Sheila Humphreys too lives on in the interviews and the films and the documentaries, but also in the legacy of her grandchildren. And this is so true of other descendants of those women too. And so the papers and the photographs preserved, not only in University College Dublin archives, but elsewhere, and the Kilmainham Jail repository, autograph books and jail souvenirs, and what remains on the walls of the jail itself, the graffiti, the calendar marking days when it rained and the sun shone, and the verses and dedications to some lost love, some forgotten, some remembered. I walk away thinking there are still more women to find, to be recalled and reclaimed into the present and into living memory. This was the 5th of the Manol 100 Centenary Podcasts, part of the Decade of Centenaries programme, the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and will tune in again.